Welcome to a Shot in the Arm podcast with me, Ben Plumley, and we are recording this podcast in New York, and you'll see some familiar faces around the table. First up, we're joined by Yvette Raphael, my sister, co-host, and general fabulous person here around the UN General Assembly. Yvette, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Ben, and how are you?
I'm knackered, can I just say. It's been a really stressful UN General Assembly, hasn't it?
Yeah. Yes, but I'm taking it easy. I'm doing what I want to do, and this is one of the things I want to do.
Well, and this is one of the things that I want to do, because we are also joined by our very good friend, also friend of the pod, Emily Bass. Hey, how are you?
Hello, I'm great now that I'm here.
It's been a day for you as well, right?
It's been a day.
So we thought in this podcast we would cover two main issues. The first is looking at where we are with the state of the US response to global AIDS, and particularly the issues that are facing PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Fund for AIDS Relief. And then I just wanted to get both of your thoughts on on how we address some of the growing challenges that we've all faced around African leadership, women's African leadership, and what is the role of us whiteies.
Why are we a challenge? Maybe we'll get to that.
We will absolutely get to that.
Don't make it a challenge.
Or why we perhaps are challenged. And we're getting into it.
Yes.
So look, let's start off with PEPFAR. Emily, you wrote To End a Plague, which was, I think, the definitive history of PEPFAR. And what are your feelings now, given that, I don't know, it may or may not be renewed, it may stop, it may continue, it may, who knows?
Well, when I wrote To End a Plague, I really didn't intend it to be a history of something that was history. and we really might be in that moment. The short answer right now with PEPFAR is we don't know. We don't know precisely what's going to happen. And that uncertainty is, frankly, shocking. And I thought I was beyond shock in the partisan climate and culture wars that have been defining America for the last long while. But essentially, we have a program that both Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals, the left and the right, in Congress and outside of Congress, have loved and supported and reauthorized in five-year legislation three times since the original law was passed in 2003. And it gets very technical very quickly, but reauthorization means you're again passing a law that says what the U.S. is going to do with its money to fight global AIDS. It doesn't mean the money's going to go away if we don't have the law, but it means that sense of purpose, that sense of congressional oversight, that sense of ambition do go away. And when we are very close to changing the nature of the epidemic in many countries and very far in others that desperately need investment, to lose that structure and focus and target is frankly unthinkable.
How did we get here?
Well, tell me, raise your hand when this sounds familiar. People are terrified about women having control over their bodies.
Yes, and most definitely. And I think from where I'm sitting, I'm just wondering what is Africa going to do without the PEPFAR? I mean, so many of our governments are not able to fund the HIV response and rely so much on it. Myself am part of those people who were so proud. Proud of PEPFAR, proud and happy that I was part of a program. I told my story in your book, Emily, about how I felt and what I did to feel make PEPFAR part of my life. So I feel a little bit sad at that people can just make that decision. I actually wanted to say, can that not be a political decision at some point? I think I mentioned it to somebody. I was like, the way PEPFAR does good in some of our countries and the way advocates fight for PEPFAR in our countries, can it not be a political decision, you know? And yeah, I'm a little bit sad, but proud.
I'm not quite understanding that. Can it not be a political decision?
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Can politicians not use aid to score political games? That is how I feel, and that happens all the time. We saw with, you know, with some of the rules around abortion and choice. I know we did some crazy advocacy together, but some of those things make such a beautiful initiative just look ugly because it depends on how someone feels.
Well, and I think the reality of what PEPFAR has been able to do and which what you've experienced, it has, the way that we got here is that it's frankly been the subject of misinformation, right? Which has been another storyline in the U.S. for the last long while, is that people make things up. And then that becomes news, and that becomes reality, and that becomes the justification for various things. And in this case, how we got here, in part, is the manufacture of a storyline that PEPFAR pays for abortions.
Which it doesn't.
It doesn't. Like, it just doesn't. It absolutely doesn't. There are two different pieces of legislation that are in place that already prohibit U.S. foreign aid from being used to provide, refer for, or advocate for abortions. It simply doesn't. And I know that you've navigated this in your work, in your feminist-oriented activism over the years, what it means to have really valuable support from a program that does not engage in certain kinds of advocacy, certain kinds of services, certain kinds of spaces, right? It doesn't do it. But this was sort of excavated. This issue has been litigated and hashed out and disproven and dispensed with. It was brought back up like some kind of zombie in April. And Chris Smith in the House of Representatives, who's a huge PEPFAR champion, has an opportunity to gain favor, gain political traction by playing into this anti-abortion moment in the United States, and therefore pulls a program that does not provide or resource advocacy for abortion into the midst of a really bloody culture war. And that's frankly how we got here, is that there's a relatively small group of people in Congress who believe this misinformation and are promulgating it, but there's many more Republicans who are very afraid to stand up for what they know is right. And so what we need to do is create conditions where legislators from both sides of the aisle can be bold and decisive and proud and saying, I support this. My views on abortion may or may not be pro or anti, but I support this because this is not about abortion.
But again, why now? I mean, these issues have been raised by the sort of the more extreme elements. Were there things like reports from the Heritage Foundation? I recall reading that there was a suggestion that HIV is now a lifestyle disease again, and that the U.S. shouldn't be spending its hard-earned money on fixing bad behavior in Africa.
Well, I don't want to punt this, but I wonder, you know, from the outside looking in, what's going on with America?
I just think it's around fear. Let's put it all out there. And as you know, I'm a fearless activist. It's just around the fear of the unknown. Let's not forget what's happening in Africa, where the politics are going, Russia, all kinds of things are playing into this fear that Americans have. And I don't think we are too innocent into playing into that. So my president being one, there's a lot of things that I sometimes sit and I like, do people really think around just what their small actions of trying to be brave or trying to sound cool, the impact thereof? You know, I have a very good friend of mine, and he always says to me, does our president know the ramification of some of the things he utters and some of the things he says? I know you are Cyril Ramaphosa fan, but I mean, really, Ben,
I'm a fan of the old Cyril Ramaphosa from the old days.
Before Marikana.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Just to be clear. But look, hey, look, you know, Chief Buthelezi just passed, and he was our family was a huge fan of his. So, yeah, enough said on that. But Back to PEPFAR. Is there a way forward?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, I will either find a way or make one. I mean, there really has to be, right? There has to be. I don't think that we can surrender this program. We can't surrender the program because HIV is not over. And the work that I think we're going to talk about in a little bit of handing over or integrating HIV responses into country-led and country-owned systems has been ongoing, and it has distance to cover. And there are groups of people for whom HIV, including new HIV infections, are daily reality. Adolescent girls and young women, lesbians, gay people, transgender people, people in prison, migrants, people who are moving because of climate disasters and then having to engage in sex work, people choosing to engage in sex work in places where various kinds of behavior or identity are criminalized. Those people are among the groups where aid, where resources from PEPFAR, resources from the Global Fund have been crucial in supporting programs led by and for community-based organizations that may be deregistered or criminalized by the governments, right? Let's be really clear, they're not providing abortions, right? That's not what is going on. That doesn't mean that PEPFAR funding doesn't support human rights and doesn't do some bold work in countries where the governments are causing people to live in terror, right? Let's just call that out, including Uganda, a country that I lived in and that we know is in one of many that is really creating conditions of terror.
I wanted to come back to Uganda and see whether you both feel that there is a connection between what is considered a victory on the far right in the United States in having been able finally to champion legislation that goes through the parliament and is signed into law by the president, and then this reframing of, or this attempt to reframe PEPFAR as an agent of abortion. Do you see linkages there or not?
I mean, here's the thing, and when you brought up fear, I think this really touched on it. When PEPFAR launched in 2003, and for many years, there was an appetite in America for, and among conservatives as well, for America as a force for moral good, America as a source of compassionate largesse to those whom much is given, much is expected, is one of President George Bush's, W. Bush's favorite pieces of scripture to quote. And we are now in a fear-based politics where national security is more important. You know, there was a moment in the vice in the presidential debate recently where a candidate, Vivek Ramaswamy, basically turned to Mike Pence, another candidate from the sort of Reagan era, and Reagan used to say it's mourning in America. Well, like, mourning for who, by the way? But he would say, and you know, Ramaswamy, the candidate, said, you know, it's not mourning in America. It's we're in dark days. And this, if you're in dark days, then you're not doing the right thing for compassionate reasons. You're not, you're only doing sort of security and fear-based things. And so I do see a connection in the sense that a lot of different repressive behaviors that are actually long-term agendas by authoritarian states in different countries are able to flourish in a fear-based moment where security is the concern, resource scarcity is the concern, poverty, everybody is afraid. And therefore, security over compassion, security over human rights. And when you move from mourning to dark days, you can do all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Well, let us try and think about sunrise and change tack a bit. I think all three of us have felt that there is a seismic shift happening right now around the way. You certainly see it in the AIDS response, but it's not limited to it, that African leadership, and particularly African civil society leadership led by women, is now really beginning to call the shots on the agendas, the needs, and telling us whiteys what we should and shouldn't do in support. And it's a painful birth, And it's hard for, I guess, people like us to understand exactly where we fit in. Emily, you and I have spoken many times about, in this new environment, what is our responsibility? Mm. Where do we make a difference? But it's an unhappy birth. It's a painful birth, but it's a birth nonetheless.
Yes, and if it's not painful and it's not uncomfortable, then we are not changing. If we are not able to be honest with each other, like we've been, I mean, I am particularly very fortunate with having both of you as my friends and my colleagues that I respect, but also the ability that I can tell you some of the hard stuff. And somebody asked me the other day, why do you always surrounded by these two? I said, one of the big things is I can call them out. And more than me calling them out, they keep checking their privilege. Is this okay? Am I doing the right thing? And I want that journey to continue, but I also want us to start respecting Black leadership. I want us to start respecting female leadership. And that problem doesn't only come from white people. It's also me being a leader in a community where I'm seen, I said this previously, where I'm seen as an aunt. And when I am a leader of an organization, it's my aunt's little shop. You know, and we don't see it in the bigger picture. There's so many challenges that we face as leaders. I see leaders going into some of my friends, my colleagues going into these powerful positions. But sometimes I worry that are these positions just there to make Black leaders fail, or do we really, really support Black leadership, and do we want to literally have Yvette have a say? I don't only fight whiteness, I also fight patriarchy. I also fight Black men in organizations. I also fight how my own colleagues see me. So leadership and women's leadership and civil society leadership is one of the things that we have to start thinking around, and how can we equip leaders and have that space where leaders like myself, leaders like, I don't want to name other people's names because maybe they don't go through what I'm going through. So let's listen to the leadership, but that transition, let it also not be some nice to have. Let it be a real transition that we are doing.
And how do we make it real? Because we really do run the risk of this being yet another tokenism.
We have to understand that sometimes Ben has the expertise and it's my time to lead. How can I lean on Ben to literally advise me genuinely and help me through a process of, I don't want to say mentorship, but strategy change. You can't be mentoring somebody forever. And also help me with that strategizing around leadership. And yeah, we have to start doing that. But the big thing is power. How does whiteness, how do men really give up all that power that they, you know, they have when they walk in the corridors, when they walk around, and give that over to women? It's a story for another day.
Well, you say that, and you're being very generous. I think you're being right about Emily, but being very generous to me. It's still something that sort of baked into us is a sense that we know best for you. The Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-American civilization is one that has brought so much good to the world. And you really see that when it comes to global health, because whether it's, and no offense to the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, whether it's the London academia, whether it is the US academia, particularly the East Coast, that there is something that we need to give to you. Whereas, and this is where I do agree that the mentor language is completely wrong. This is completely a two-way street.
Yes.
I mean, how much have I learned from you?
It has to be an exchange. And whether you're learning or not, Ben, really, that's up to you. You understand it's an individual's failure to see potential, to see the next human being as a human, and that they have their own brain and they are smart, but they might just be thinking around certain things differently. I think that is what it is. I think we all bring uniqueness into a leadership role. We all bring uniqueness into the field. And I think just learn from Africans. We are the experts of our own lives. We are experts of our own strategies. I still use what I've learned from my grandmother. And Emily, you know this best, because it is how I'm raised, regardless of how people come around and bring new technology and all those kind of things around me. For me, importantly, is who I am. And are you able to learn from me? Are you able to learn my feminism? Are you able to learn how I lead? And I lead with Ubuntu, and you come and just take advantage of my humanity. Ubuntu means humanity. Do white people know that?
Do they know humanity? Do we know humanity?
Yes, Ubuntu means humanity. Don't take advantage of my Ubuntu. Don't take advantage of my humanity. I might look like I'm submissive, but that's my humanity. That's how I'm raised. Can you appreciate the fact that I just respect you? And it's not because I'm dumb.
I mean, I think I would push it further. I think that it is there's bidirectional learning. I think that if you look at where we've gotten with global health, with pandemic responses, but also the roots and the drivers and the sort of the rupture in history that was transatlantic slave trade and then everything else that sort of stems from that, right, including all of these pandemics, including HIV, right? You know, I think that part of the transfer of a power shift is really in most, if not all, situations where there's racial and geographic differences for the white people or the people with white privilege, however that's assigned, to assume that they don't know, to assume that they don't know enough, to assume that they don't know. I don't know if it would be, I don't know anything, but to really approach from a place of presumed deficit. And that's really dangerous. It's threatening to white men for, you know, because they're used to knowing everything, and white women, like all women, if you say, I don't know, then people are going to assume you're just sort of a ding dong, right? So there's two different, there's risks there, but I don't think that we're going to get the transformation that we need if we're not really, really honest about the ways that ignorance, the ways that lack of curiosity about the capacities, the skills, the histories, the cultures, the teachings from elders are not brought into the spaces. If we're not sort of curious about how those erasures and those silences have caused the problems that we're getting paid to solve, then we're going to see the problems continue. So you, to me, it's arriving with way more humility than I see right now, and then I think that also has, you know, to be just perfectly honest, yes, go.
Yes, Emily, I totally agree with you, but sometimes I almost feel this condescending way of speaking when people do talk about, I would like for you to lead, Yvette, and then I keep quiet. I sit in a corner with all of the knowledge that I have, hoping that, I'll wait for the black people to make a mistake so that I can rescue it.
Yeah.
So I think let's just operate on a level of respect, a level of you know some and I know some, a level of exchanging of knowledge, and so much better. And if we've been working together and you almost feel like, okay, there's a transition that needs to happen, don't make it condescending. Mm. Don't say, I don't know if it's my place. You've been forward all your time, all your life. You've been out there being the first one to speak. Continue speaking. Give me the agency to challenge that, and in a respectful manner. But if you sit around, I don't know, I don't want to say anything today because I don't know how the black people are going to feel.
I don't think it's silence, though. I don't think it's, what I'm talking about is curiosity. Well, I hear you, and I'm going to think about how I could say that differently, because I don't mean sort of, I can't possibly talk because I don't know anything. But I mean going, you know, I'm not going to assume that my approach is correct.
Yes.
You and I are going into a meeting together, Yvette, you know, here's what I'm thinking, or here's my readout. And then if you tell me, you know what, let's do it differently. I'll follow your lead. I think it's that curiosity, but then also giving up being right all the time.
Yes.
Right?
Giving that up, but also let's go from a point of view, how do you want us to approach this? Mm-hmm. Because you know already you have this, it's going to take forever to remove white privilege, guys. Yeah. Let's not lie to each other. It's going to take forever for me to see a white person not as the be all and end all, as regardless of how educated, how out there I am, how fearless I am as an advocate. So how are we going to work together? It's like, we're going into this meeting. How do you want us to approach it? Do you take the first 30 minutes? Do I take this? How do we get to a point where we are not, we appreciate what each other bring? I it would be so wrong for me to say I don't need white people in my life. Yes, but how do we move from a respectful way mm-hmm. and working together, and you always checking your privilege, but also not me calling you out, but calling you in. I keep saying this because this is what I've learned, is calling Ben in instead of in the middle of something calling Ben out and say, this is how you have to do it. So for me, that is just, like I say, Ubuntu bam, my humanity. And I want us to, and I talk about how disenfranchising can that can also be just being humble and somebody thinks you're stupid. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that is, I think, a particular problem with, how shall I put it, the public health education we have had in the last 30, 40 years. We're given the tools to tell people who know less than us, allegedly, how to do things, whether they are the poor in the north of England, the poor in the southern states of the United States, or the continent of Africa, the country of Africa.
Yes, and I...
But can I... Oh, I'm interrupting.
Yes, but I can... I would like to make an example with my own community, not so far away from where I stay in Alexander. And while everybody was making all of this noise about what they know around COVID and how we need to... and how we're going to have to stop everybody. Everybody has to wear a mask. This community survived, and they found ways on how to manage all of that. And yeah, I just want to say expertise is also very, not really expert sometimes.
I wanted to put to both of you this idea that perhaps this is a particular problem of white progressives and white liberals. And it sort of ties us back to the PEPFAR question, in that we perhaps take so much for granted. And if you look at the number of leaders of international organizations, civil society organizations, global civil society organizations, the number of people who look like you, as opposed to the number of people who look like me, it's still a major, major mismatch. And I don't know how we go about educating ourselves about how that has to change and how we have to change. And it's only in that context that I think the decolonialist term is right. We're not decolonializing anybody else. We have to decolonialize our own approaches, our own cultural beliefs, our own baggage. And I guess, do you both feel that that is perhaps a particular problem for progressives?
Yeah, I always say our biggest problem is the liberals, the guys who think, who know, have the language. It's like they understand the language, they know how to speak, and it's in that speaking and that talking that you realize, you're just as problematic as what you're trying to say you're preventing, because you just know how to speak it. And I would say, my aha moment was when my daughter said, we're doing it all wrong. You can't bring the colonizer to the table to decolonize anything, public health. And I was like, wow, I've been having these conversations with the wrong people then. So yeah, for me, that is that, Ben, is how do we really, and I want to say from a point of respect, in a point of knowing, in a point of you checking yourself, and also understanding where I come from when with my humility and my humanity.
Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, there's two pieces. I think that it's interesting to think about PEPFAR, right? PEPFAR was a Republican initiative, and it was reviled by the left when it was launched because the idea was we should just, all the money should go to the Global Fund, which was a multilateral, and then countries could decide. And there's a bit of this idea that, you know, all, you know, African country governments are somehow just by definition good actors, you know, incorruptible, good actors, they're going to do the right thing, that if we just gave it to the countries, everything would work out. And PEPFAR was an extremely micromanaged, bilateral, targeted program. And in certain countries, Uganda was the one that I was in, but I know from reporting, and you know from lived experience in South Africa, it moved incredibly quickly in spaces where the government could not operate. So there was a sort of essentializing, in a way, to me, of the African government or the African nation as being, you know, there's no possible room for a sort of ambitious US-driven program. So I think that's an example for me. I think sometimes where the progressive, you know, sort of what sounds right isn't always what's needed, and that actually has weakened PEPFAR right now because the president, you asked if we're going to make a way or find one, President Biden needs to make this an issue. The White House, the Oval Office must make this a priority, must deliver this, must say this is important. But unfortunately, the president, I think, has been hearing for years from people who have always thought that PEPFAR was a bad idea, from other development agencies who are sad that they're not running PEPFAR. And so, and those are liberals, those are Democrats. PEPFAR has never, the worst jeopardy was in prior to this moment was under Obama-Biden.
Yeah.
But I want to also get personal about where you were talking with progressives, because there's colonialism, but there's capitalism. Mm-hmm. And what we need to talk about is that, it, you know, beyond humility, beyond the risk to ego to admit, I don't know, not say, I don't know, I'm not going to talk, just to be, and my earlier remarks is really thinking about progressives who I know more or less the right things to say, I hope, right? But sometimes I should realize that I may be wrong about what those are. I may, you know, so that's sort of where I was going with that earlier. But capitalism, we're all trying to pay the rent. We're all trying to put our kids in school, maybe send them to summer camp, get a new outfit, you know, whatever it is. And until white people figure out where the economy is, white people in the global health economy figure out how they have income security, nothing's going to change. Nothing is going to change, right? Let's just be totally honest. And so what is a global health architecture and a global health economy going to look like where the roles are properly apportioned, the skills are properly apportioned, and the resources, both to countries but also to households and individuals, are properly apportioned? That's, we got to solve that problem. We got to solve the paycheck problem, to be just perfectly honest, or no person of any color is going to move out of their seat of power.
No, but I mean, what you're talking about is the differentiators in pay, right? Mm-hmm. That we in the North have our salaries, but those folks working for us in the global South have significantly less salaries.
So what do you? So the issue is that we can't separate redistribution of power from paychecks, and that doesn't mean that anybody that's doing this work is doing it just for the money. And it's not about haves and have-nots, or even in this case, really about pay differentials between global North and South, and or between men and women, which also matter. But it's really about talking about an economy where asking leaders of organizations to step aside, to give leadership and authentic power. In this case, we're talking about white leaders and black leaders, but global North and global South, is that there are economic considerations for all of us. How are we paying school fees? How are we saving for retirement? And if we don't address and don't create a global health architecture and economy where people have paychecks, people in power who might be able to do something else as additionally, as additive as what they're doing now, they're not going to move as readily out of their executive suites. Some of that is about liking to have power, and some of that is about needing a paycheck. And I think we need to have difficult conversations about money, about salary, about compensation for different kinds of work, as part of creating spaces for new leaders?
That's a conversation we're not having. We're keeping it at surface level, at the fact that we have competing priorities, competing yeah. salaries. Is that somebody in South Africa or in Ghana or Uganda gets far much less than our competitors in the US, or somebody who does it even for much less in the US? And that's truly very shallow to think about.
Well, but the and again, it's like, I don't know, there's a clock ticking. I can see my consultancies dwindling as I'm talking.
Right, I'm thinking,
I can see the money disappearing. But like, we talking about money is part of the hard conversation.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's you know, African-based salaries may be different, but you know, for very smart, you know, well-intentioned people who've been effective at fundraising, great at doing, you know, all of the capacities that exist in white leadership, people are not ready to retire. Like, literally, what is the job? How do we reconfigure a job market?
How do we put ourselves out of jobs? I mean,
how do we get ourselves the appropriate jobs?
Well, get ourselves out of the jobs playing that leadership role. Yeah, how do we get ourselves the appropriate jobs? Well, yes, we have sort of come to the top of the hour, and I feel that there is a lot that we could really go into in much more detail. And this is really just the start of the conversation. I want to thank you both very much for being brutally honest and giving me the space to be equally brutally honest and to listen from you both. I think it's a really important thing that A Shot in the Arm continues to explore these issues. That's why, you know, your leadership as co-host is so important, Yvette, to drive those conversations. I just thank you, and we'll be back for more.
Thanks for sitting there and listening to me not only rant but talk my reality and my truth as well. And I want to acknowledge Emily as well for the hard truths. I mean, you two are my white people.
We heard it there. Hey ho, well, that's it for this episode. Hope you enjoyed it. I know for many of us working in global health, it was a tough one to listen to, but one we really, really have to start having. So thanks to Emily, thanks to Yvette. Thanks to our director and producer, Erica Spera of Newsdoc Media, Chad Harrisman, our New York producer. Our production coordinator is Waisha Raphael, and our intern is Will Lansdale. We are a project of the Global Listening Project. Hope you have a great week and a safe week, everyone.